Hi, Sandra. You wanted to explore this topic of tuition and intuition. And maybe it's easiest if I start with where it all started. It started the way before, actually, before it all started. Because tuition and intuition was a project which I initiated decades ago after I was out of medical school. And it was based on the realization that a lot of the education which people get is impractical, because for many that what they learn is not what they use. And I need to go back to my engineering school days and my medical school days. In both of the cases I was a student faculty member, and that meant that I was given information which students normally wouldn't get. And in engineering school, it was the finding that 60% of the engineers do not do what they were educated for. They end up doing something totally different, which of course poses the question, what is it that you teach them if they don't use it? Or even if they don't use it, then how useless is that what they are being taught? That was connected to a method of thinking which I at some point described in an essay called Errol versus Rulle, which was a little word game of fictitious characters. RL was the acronym for the Rijksuniversiteit Leiden, the University of Leiden, and Rulle, the Rijksuniversiteit Limburg, was where I later did my medical school training. In the Rijksuniversiteit Leiden, like most of the universities, they have these pulpits where people talk about something, and then people in an auditorium take notes, and then they're supposed to regurgitate what they have been learning. And actually, as many people in schools also have experienced, it means that one of the trainings which they undergo is that they need to regurgitate what they have been told, undigested. It is as if they were given a carrot to eat, and then at the exam they have to vomit back the carrot as it was presented to them. They're not supposed to turn it into a carrot salad or into cooked carrot with something else. There is a limitation on the kind of meaning which that information then can take. That is very different from how it was done in the Rijksuniversiteit Leiden, the school in Maastricht, which was using the method of problem-based learning developed at McMaster's, which is essentially where students sit around in a circle in a group of eight, and then together they discuss a topic about which they know nothing. For example, the first topic that we had was Mr. Jones goes to the doctor and has a broken leg. No, a patient goes to a doctor and has a broken leg. So that was the whole topic, that was the theme of that meeting. And so the students together had to find out, okay, what do we know about it? What would it be about? What kind of information do we need? Where can we find that information? How will we put it together? So it's a totally opposite way of learning, because the students learn to study for themselves. And they also start by questioning the question. So the patient comes to the doctor. It doesn't matter how old or young the patient is. Doesn't matter if it is a male or a female. Then, of course, it is evident that, yeah, if there's a broken leg involved, with children, the healing is very different than with older people or aged people. And for women and men, it is different too, because the hormones that play a role are different, and the hormone balances are different too. And one of the important explorations or discoveries in that exploration was, that patient comes to the doctor, at some point we'll be that doctor. We need to know what we would be doing. So that's quite the opposite of this ex cathedra from the pulpit kind of teaching, which basically the model of tuition, because the students need to discover for themselves what is their interest, but also what responsibility do they take in what they learn and how they learn. So it's a much deeper level of education. It's a much more connected level of education, because it makes sure that the students are always in touch with their interest. They know why they came to do that specific studies. They don't have that difficulty that somebody on a pulpit says, you now have to know this, you now have to know that, and you have to regurgitate it just as we told us, and otherwise you get a fail mark. Instead, they knew the topic, they were free to go around the topic or go deeper into the topic or get different aspects of the topic, because they might not become orthopedic surgeons dealing with broken legs, but be family doctors having to deal with osteoporosis or the pill changing the hormone balance and thus the bone repair or maintenance qualities. In that approach, people are also much more free to tailor make their own education in the direction where they think they might be going. So if initially they think that they might want to become an orthopedic surgeon, they can collect all of the information from that perspective and already know how that would be before they even start that specialism training. So even though they are still following a tuition curriculum, they can follow their intuition and their own life goals. And it might be practical or fun to add that these were not just about different approaches in teaching or learning. The general tendency of universities that they're about teaching, and the McMaster problem-based learning is about learning. So they're complementary views, but they were also complementary in the way of the examination. In the tuition kind of teaching, the ex cathedra preacher mode, the exams would be a series of questions, and then the student has to give the answer as the teacher would have had presented it in the class if it had been presented. Often it is not a topic that has actually been presented, but something related to it indirectly. So in a way they hope that the students have looked around and understood that there is a more general meaning to what was taught and can apply that in a slightly different context. But the students, of course, have not learned to deal with that. So the fail rate in those kind of exams is quite high. And the alienation rate in that kind of tuition is quite high as well, because the students get this focus on the exam. They also have a strange kind of involvement with this exam in this tuition mode of education, because as soon as they have had the exam and passed it, then they forget all about what they have learned. In a sense, it is like they walk through a room and at the exit door they have to talk a bit about their experience in that room, and once they've left that room they never need go there again. Which also means that they don't revisit that information, they don't get updates, they don't have the possibility to validate if that information which they got was actually correct, because when they're tested, if they find that there is a different way of looking at it, they get a fail mark. So they're actually taught not to think, and not to question. And there's also the psychological double bind. As part of my curriculum, I also learned how to become a teacher. And there, one of the thoughts which I found was that a teacher, school teacher, university teacher, any teacher, is at the same time had the magician who gives access to the pearls of wisdom of the world, and at the on the other hand also the executioner, which will punish you, decapitate you if necessary, disallowing you to live on in that specific branch of education. So it's also in a way an assassin. Can you live that life path, or are you executed? So when the teacher is also the punisher, how much can you trust the teacher, and how much can you love the punisher? Because that contradiction, of course, is totally disconnected from the student themselves. And in that line of thought, I was introduced to the story of the life experience of Évariste Galois, a mathematician who never became a mathematician. There is a branch of mathematics called the Galois mathematics, and Évariste Galois applied, according to the story I heard, to the Sorbonne University in Paris a couple of times. And each time he was rejected, because the questions which he got posed, he didn't answer in the way that the teacher was looking for the answer. And the story goes that disillusioned Évariste Galois then initiated a duel about a girl he couldn't much care for with a guy he knew to be much stronger than himself. So instead of, well, he had himself suicided, so to say. And then there was a strange series of coincidences, because it turned out that his landlady did not just throw away all his stuff, but she found a bundle of papers in the back of his desk, and then was able to contact, I think it was a law student, a friend of his, and that friend got the bundle of papers, and somehow that friend then realized that there was something important there, and as a result from those bits of paper the Galois mathematics was then discovered, and it was realized that Galois mathematics is a totally different way of solving mathematical problems, which he did at his entrance exam a couple of times. And the teachers were just not clever enough to understand that. I had a similar kind of experience myself while I was in teacher training, because there were two of us following the teaching training with a woman who had been the first engineer in an aeronautics department. And that's an interesting story too, because as she discovered, as one woman amongst 200 men, pretty woman too, she was ogled a lot, but disregarded and disrespected in all other ways. And even though she was top class, she discovered that as a woman she was battling against these men all the time. And at the end of her studies, she just made the calculation, applying the mathematics that she had learned, doing the integral sum of how much money would she make as an engineer, having to battle against all of these guys all the time, and knowing what kind of starting salary, what kind of end salary she would have. You can draw a curve on how much it would add up over time, with the pension that can be estimated to come out of that, and how much money would she earn if she was a school teacher, And she discovered that it sort of evened out. And she became a school teacher, and she taught me a lot because she had realized that in teaching secondary school, around the time where compulsory schooling stops and children do not have to continue their education by law, she would then talk with the students after they came back from the summer holidays, say, ladies and gentlemen, I call you ladies and gentlemen now, because I know that by law you're no longer required to follow the school curriculum. So I know that you come here by your own volition, and I can only assume that you come here because you want to study this topic and that you want to be good at it. So I commit to you that I will be the best teacher that I can be for you, but I also expect from you that you will be the best student that you will be able to be for yourself, because from here on the quality of your education is determined by your own performance and your own abilities to learn and apply that. Actually, she was the top teacher with the top scores of the whole region. And while I was there, my companion apprentice teacher was explaining a specific form of mathematics. We were teaching physics and the mathematics of that. And a girl in the class who was shy and normally didn't speak up at that point said, well, the solution which I see is that and that. And then the guy said, no, that's not correct. And basically chopped her down, which was visible, because she had understood something. She had seen something. And he just chopped her down. So she closed up. And I couldn't interfere because it was his turn to teach. And so I could only go to that girl later on and said, actually, what you said was very correct. But it is a more advanced form of mathematics, which not everybody knows. And yes, you can indeed, in that way, solve the problem. So you were right. So she was, say, the Évariste Galois in the class. And from that approach, I then learned that if you have a school, a tuition schooling system in which people have, say, the saint and the devil both incarnate in the teacher, giving the gems of wisdom but also giving the punishment as the executioner. With that kind of approach, you cannot say much about what happens if somebody passes or fails the exam. If somebody passes the exam, it simply means that at that moment in time, on that specific day, they had that information which the teacher thought was correct. So it's essentially a matching of expectation and projection, which is a psychological interaction rather than a scientific action. But then, of course, if the student passes, that doesn't say much. It's just that the teacher agrees with what the student did, or the student agrees with what the teacher did, and that's the end of story. Basically boring. It's more interesting because it's more diverse if the student fails, because is it because the student did not study and just doesn't have any interest in the topic, or didn't have any interest in that exam and just didn't contribute anything relevant in the answer of that examination question? Or is it that the student found a different answer, maybe had a different way of thinking, and it was not the student that failed the exam, but it was the teacher who failed the exam because the teacher didn't know anything else than the answer that the teacher knew, and what the student added was actually valid, but the teacher didn't know it. It could also be that the teacher and the student both were trapped in that the books the teacher was using were incomplete. It could well be that the student's answer became a presentation, say in a publication 3 weeks later, or a month later, or a year later. It wasn't in the books yet. And if you look at the progress of science, then essentially you always have the scientists who create the progress of intelligence, information. So it could well be that somewhere a scientist already has a new insight, but hasn't communicated about it yet. So science knows it because the scientist knows it, but nobody else knows it yet. Or maybe the scientist has already written a letter to one of his colleagues. Nowadays that would be an email. So in the past, the scientists would correspond with each other, and out of that correspondence came a further deepening of the insight, which might lead to have from the direct knowledge of the scientist to the communication with the colleagues and friends to a monograph, that there is a private publication of that information for a small group of people. And then from there on, it might go into a publication of a book, which goes to many people. And there are delays of, say, 40 years in that trajectory. So at the moment that a researcher finds something new, that's instantaneous, that on that day. At the moment that it is communicated to friends or colleagues, it might be after the weekend or the next week, and by the time that the response comes, that might be a couple of weeks or a month or two later, maybe a year. Then by the time it goes into a monograph, that would be a year, maybe 2 years later. By the time that it goes to publication, that might be decades later. Some of these findings in publications are very old. Darwin, his theory, of course, was easily refutable now, but he only published at the end of his life because he was fearing the wrath of the church, because freedom of thought is often talked about, but often hindered and crippled. We've just seen that as well in this whole COVID story, where researchers showed that there are different ways to think about it, and then communication devices, instruments and platforms censored that away, because in that sense we are not far away from the Middle Ages. So in that sense, when there is a student failing the exam, is it because the student fails, is it because the teacher fails, or is it because there's an error in the books, or is it because science still has to go, that's the fourth level of the error, which the present science still have to realize that what they were thinking and how they were thinking about it was totally wrong. How there are many examples in science and other forms of research where people have believed something and it turns out that that's not how it was. For example, if you look at the model of the atom, first it was a raisin bun, then it was a bunch of grapes, and now it's for many people still a little galaxy. What Tetrionics says, no, these are little deuterons with niches in which the electron can fit. And so when people use an obsolete paradigm, is the student wrong because the student already knows the new paradigm, or is the student wrong because the student actually conceived the new paradigm? So there is this impressive amount of error that can be made when a student fails the exam. It could be that the student fails the exam, the teacher can fail the exam, the textbook can fail the exam, or the whole discipline of science can fail the exam. And as nobody looks at the failure of the exam, that's basically where they chop off the student instead of scrutinizing the teacher, the books, and the research discipline. So there's a lack of scrutiny, and actually that lack of scrutiny is important, because as Ranulf Glanville at some point said, actually cybernetics is the only branch of science where error is appreciated. And that's also in cybernetics where they use terminology like negative feedback for positive feed forward. It is about error correction. So if an error can be made, you learn something new. That's also the philosophy of Popper, who said if you have science and you have foundations of science and you have a theory of science, it is not just about being able to prove the theory. That's not enough. You must also be able to disprove the theory. And if you cannot disprove it, that still doesn't mean that the theory is right. You can only say something about the quality of the theory if there is proof and if there is disproof, because then you know where it is right, but also you know that it is not always right. And that is something that in the education system of problem-based learning is understood. So going from the side of tuition towards the side of intuition, going from the standard ex cathedra preacher mode of teaching to the more intuitive problem-based learning approach. The examination which is used in that problem-based learning is totally different. Essentially, in medical school, when I had entered into medical school, within a couple of weeks, we all did the final doctor's exam. So the medical profession, the final graduation exam of the medical doctor, was something which was done four times a year, something. And every year again. And the possibility for answer was very simple. Yes, no, or don't know. A plus, minus, or a question mark. And the questions were always as, say, a statement, and then a declaration. And the statement said something about a topic. It introduced, presented the topic, and then had a statement which could be true or false, or if you didn't know, you could add a question mark. And that was important, because in that approach it is very relevant to know what you don't know. And I learned that in the first time that I did that exam. I got a negative score, because I thought, well, I've been to this kind of schooling before. I've been through the tuition kind of exam. So I can rely on my intuitive knowledge. I can rely on my general knowledge. And I can guess quite a bit. And then there might be some things which I actually already know. And it turned out that from what I intuitively knew, a lot of that worked. From that, what I knew from indirect knowledge, it turned out that quite a bit of that was not correct. So the general knowledge that people have is not necessarily the knowledge that doctors work with. And what I didn't know, I needed to acknowledge that better. So my negative score was simply the indicator of, okay, you're now learning how to do this exam, and over the next 6 years you will need to you'll come to understand the technology or the technique of the exam. And so for most people that was about 1 or 2, maybe 3 years in which they learned how that examination method worked. And also in that time they realized that they grew in knowledge. There were more answers available to the questions which were there. There was a greater clarity on which were evidently wrong answers as they were proposed. And the amount of unknowns, the question mark, just reduced. And the finding was also that around the fifth, and certainly at the 6th year, people would pass the medical doctor exam. The finding was also that had they compared the exam as done at the Maastricht University with the students from the other universities, and it turned out that the students of Maastricht University had a better score than the people who had just completed and passed their exams in the other universities. It meant that there is a different kind of learning involved, but also a different kind of self-assessment, of self-assertion of the knowledge involved. In that whole examination process, there is a calculation. The correct answers minus the erroneous answers leads to the score that the student gets of the exam. But when the student finds that the list of the answers, the list of the correct answers as it was estimated was published, and then every student was expected to look at their answers and compare it to the answers which were expected, but also correct and check the answers which the university had said, okay, this is the right answer. And all of the students were asked to comment, and for any answer that the university had said it is this one, and the student could show that it is not so, and there is this book which I used and it says something else, it actually proves that the other answer is the correct one, then all of those questions out of the exam, which were debated or contested, were removed from the number of valid questions on the exam. It meant that the examination process was double-sided. The educators asked the students, and the students informed the educators, and once that had been calibrated and corrected, only then was the score of the examination determined. And of course, when they first introduced this and explained how this examination system worked, the teacher who was then, well, they're not called teachers there anyhow. the guy who was talking about how this examination works, that if you have uncertainty about a question and think that there's another answer, then you let us know and we take that into account. But of course, we will not discuss something like is grass green. So I raised my hand and said, so what about Kentucky bluegrass? And the guy was totally baffled, because that was precisely the example of you are able to debate and contest even that what would otherwise not be debated or contested. I'd like to add some more about that whole examination method, because in that more intuitive kind of schooling, there was a couple of examination methods that were used. The general medical doctor exam, which came by a couple times per year from week zero to the end of the schooling, was but one of the examination approaches. That was for the theoretical knowledge. As doctors need to be proficient at specific skills, there was also a skill laboratory in which birthing, the taking of blood samples, the testing of palpation, the feeling for the inner organs, all kind of different medical techniques were practiced, and they would be demonstrated with students and with teachers looking, so that the proficiency of a specific technique could be shown and could be looked at by somebody who knew how the technique worked, so that before people went into the hospital, they already knew how to talk with patients, how to understand patients, how to help patients undress and climb on the examination table, how to examine the patient, how to do the laboratory testing, sample taking, and so on. So that one was the skills lab test set, which was done connected to say a episode or a period in which those skills were being taught, and those technical practical skills just were spaced throughout the curriculum throughout the years to go from more general to more specific as the time went on in the curriculum. The whole curriculum was based on periods of 6 weeks in which specific topics were being addressed. So that could be, for example, the menstruation era, or the bone building era, or the neuropathologies. And for each of those, there was a six-week period, and that was concluded with the same kind of yes, no, and maybe questionnaire, with the same kind of testing of the validity of the questions, but then more specific for the topic. And what was interesting was that in that approach, it was not expected that everybody passed all of those topic-based tests, for the simple reason that in the schooling, in the curriculum, they knew what I had learned in my previous participation in the engineering school, where I was told that 60% of the students ended up doing something else. So here they knew that people would not go into the specific direction of some of these more specialized topics which were being addressed. So it was important that people knew about it, because they would be required to be able to understand when to delegate questions like that to somebody else. So for example, if it was something into dermatology and they knew that they were not going there because they wanted to be a surgeon or they want to be a psychiatrist, then it was okay for them to have a meager mark on that specific topic, as long as for the other topics on general they had a pass mark, and so they could compensate by the top for the topics that didn't interest them by having high scores in the topics that do interest them. And in that way, people could also have diverse interests and have, say, top score on different specializations, and in that way open more different future pathways that they could go. But they determined that for themselves. The schooling system didn't do that. And with those three types of exam, progress was being gauged. It was actually also called a progress test. It was not a final examination test, and a topic test. But next to that, there were also other forms of education or schooling taking place. Specifically, Harry Kreboller, he was the head of the family doctor, general practitioner department. And as he said, when he felt depressed, he would walk by the man at the door of the faculty building, because every time he would walk by, John would say, "Good morning, professor. Good afternoon, professor. Good morning, professor." And so Harry Krebolle said, "You just need to walk by there a couple of times, and if you're depressed or if you have some problem, you know why you are there. You know what you're there for. You're reminded." It turned out that in that whole faculty, John, the man at the door, was the only healer, because after he went back from his place at the door and went back home, then with his dowsing rods he would help people as a psychic healer. And it was also very funny, talking about tuition and intuition in a different sense. John had been a friar in a monastery before, Friar Bernard, and at some point he had had a fall with his motorbike and had to be operated on his back, and they overdosed him on the anesthetics, as a result of which he found himself outside of his body and found himself accompanied by his life company, or his guardian angel, so to say. And from that moment on, it would be possible to talk with John about football, and because John would know about that. But you could also talk with his guardian angel, because John had the direct access with that. So at the tuition side, the daily things John would talk about, and the intuition side, his guardian angel would take over the conversation, and John would have full knowledge of both sides of it. So that brings me then to this understanding which built up out of that, that there is this inner and this outer learning, and that's also something that Harry Krebolle built up, because he realized that when students go into the medical practice, they should not become arrogant doctors like produced by so many of these other universities, where they have a book and then end up having brittle knowledge. Because in the other universities, when they're tested on the exam, they need to repeat what the book says. And if it is not as it is said in the book, they get a fail mark. But it means that they end up with brittle knowledge, because at the moment that a patient comes to them and the doctor doesn't have the answer, the doctor intuitively feels that he failed the exam and will do something else instead, fall back on the knowledge that he does have for a situation where that knowledge does not apply. So they have that brittle kind of knowledge which results from this extra ex cathedra tuition, while the people from the Maastricht University, the problem-based learning approach, at the moment that they didn't know, just as on the exam, just as in the discussions leading up to the studying, they would come up with this "I don't know." And in this group discussions, at the end of the group discussions, an inventory was made of, okay, what is it that we do not know? And at the end of that session, everybody would decide what they were going to look for, what they're going to find, and everybody did that in their own way. So when the next time they came back, the back reporting or what had been found would be very different, because some would already look at it from a specialist approach, some would look from a generalist approach, some would look from an as yet unknown perspective. And it meant that when the information came back into that group, there would be an overlap of things which were essential, there would be insights of things which were relevant, there were also ideas which said that there are more things to look at, and sometimes that would be taken up and it would be pursued as a sequel learning on that topic. But on the whole, Later on, when a patient comes to the doctor and the doctor doesn't know, the doctor simply says, I do not know. I will look that up. I'll come back to you. While I do that, please look for yourself as well, so that in our next meeting we can see what we have found. So the patient was involved in the exploration as well, and the doctor would have the possibility to not start guessing, not start to apply knowledge which was not appropriate, not to just assume that what was learned was still valid, but as a kind of ongoing learning, have a base of knowledge, say the tuition part, of the understanding that doctors can work with, but also an intuitive aspect of what else is going on, or what might be different from the normal situation. And that's also something that doctors learn in the practical phase. And in Dutch it's called pluis niet pluis. It is, how can you translate that? feeling, it feels reliable or it doesn't feel reliable. So when a doctor in the conversation or in the looking at the test result has that feeling of there is something else going on, there's something undefinable, something that might mean that things are different, that intuition is given credit. It is acknowledged. It is actually important. It is part of the training. You have the intuition part of what you learn, but you also must have that intuition part of what else is going on. The knowledge part seems to be correct, but at the intuitive part, there is a feeling, an emotion, a thought, an association, something that triggered a feeling of there's something else going on, so look into that. And that's also what Harry Kribolder helped foster by building a bridge in a program that he had created, which was called the Patient Adoption Program, in which the students, small group, pilot group, I was one of them, were invited to connect up to 3-4 different family doctors, because this was all about family medicine practice. And with these different doctors, the students would then make contact and be introduced into the home of a couple of selected patients. So these family doctors had asked some of their patients if they would be willing to help apprentice doctors, a student, to know more about what happened in their household, how they thought about medicine, how they thought about food, how they thought about education, and so on. And as a result, the students were connected to the medical doctor, who connected them to the families. They then met up with the families and discovered that simply by going to the house of the family of the patient, to see the house, to meet the family, there was a fully different kind of understanding than was possible if you see a patient in the medical practice. And so as the pilot group of students, we compared notes and we realized that some households were fitted with say the cheapest, most common kind of interior decoration materials. Some of them had family relics strewn throughout the house. Some of them had, say, the posh or the chic kind of upholstery in the household. So simply by looking around in the house, what kind of television set, what kind of curtains, how many tables, how many chairs around the table, how large is the family, how well knitted is the family. So all kind of, say, semi-intuitive notion was already available by some simple detective work of looking around in a household. And then the patients as well, introducing the family, introducing the house, introducing their setting, talking about it, explaining things, where they came from, how that came to be. Building a bridge between the curiosity of the patient in what are these young doctors interested in, what are they trying to learn, how can I help them, so they suddenly realized that they had become teachers. They had become the teachers of the new generation of doctors, which they could benefit from. And the students, on the other hand, experiencing these patients in their family, with their family, and being able to ask questions such as who determines what is being cooked, what people eat, and the finding that most often it was the grandmother who determined what people were eating, because in most of the household it was the woman who was doing the cooking. This was a minor district, so many people still had a history of that mining industry taking place there. So the men would go out for work and the women would take care of the household, and the woman would have learned the cooking from her mother, and so often that would still echo in the way they lived their lives. So it was not just that you were seeing a patient and the family, but in a way the grandparents were very much present in their health story as well. So that led to a enlarging of the perspective in my own realization, having been in engineering school with these preachers on the pulpit talking about information which sometimes was obsolete already, and giving examples which were very selectively filtered as well, because at that time I was a student assistant, I had my income out of that, and it meant that I helped students to learn about a specific kind of electric testing setup. But then of course that specific test demonstrated, in that case, the law of Ohm, but a test which would have put a question to that law of Ohm, of course, was not selected. So that gave me insight in how limited the teaching was, as a result of which, again, that brittleness of that learning which comes from that. And from the engineering school, I had already learned that most of the students who went through that system did something else than what they have been taught. So I had that knowledge, and then I also had that knowledge of the and the experience of the other approach of the problem-based learning, in which students together for themselves in interaction with doctors and with patients learned things. And actually in that approach, doctors were not preachers, but they were people that you could consult. They were specifically not being regarded as people who know. They were simply regarded as people who had experience, and from their experience had a specific approach. But as a student, you needed to look around that and look into the books and talk with others, talk with colleagues, to see if there were more views which were valid, which led to a much more integrated kind of learning and also a much more practice connected insight, and also, as mentioned before, an inclusion of intuition. So after I had concluded both of these schoolings, I had been thinking about what I was going to do next, and as a consequence I participated in various conferences where I presented my findings, which were about four-dimensional dynamic logic, which is something totally different, with the applications on body, mind, soul, and spirit, which is for many of the conferences totally different yet again. And of course, that was dealing with the kind of knowledge and understanding which most people didn't have. So I started to look more into how do people learn and how do people create their own reliance on that what they know. I already talked about my experience as a teacher apprentice and with the fallacies of the examination system. But the fallacy is also there in the learning system, because when people are taught that their curriculum has all of the answers, then that leads to people with a very limited knowledge. As I mentioned before, the books on which they base their information are, say, 40 years old, maybe 400 years old. And as a result, that kind of information does not match what is being published. Nowadays, of course, there is a shortening of that time gap between what's in a book and what's in somebody's head doing a new discovery, because somebody who has a new discovery can now send an email. That email can immediately be forwarded to other people who are sort of knowledgeable about that. Some of that might be forwarded to people who have no knowledge about it but might see the relevance of it, and that means that the transmission of information is much quicker than it was before, so that when people acquire new insights, they are much closer to the anvil, so to say. It also means that when people are at conferences presenting something, the people who are there are often much more open to having new insight. And in my approach or in my experience, I realized that I needed to be selective in where I participated in conferences. First of all, I realized that a lot of the conferences were just a traveling circus. And they were driven by an American principle called publish or perish. Because in American university circuits, at some point, a demand had been imposed that if people did not publish enough, they might lose their job. And the horrific counterpart of that is that, on the one hand, people would start to publish the same paper again and again and again, because the people who counted the amount of publications realized that they wouldn't understand what was being published anyhow. So they just looked at the number of publications that somebody had been put out. And I was at some of these, say, engineering conferences or medical conferences, and I realized that people would just tell the same story year after year. Or the other way around, when people were presenting their stories, those people who had to be there because of the publish or perish principle would then attend to those lectures, and at the end, question time, would say, have you read this, have you read that? Basically having no interest in what the others said, but wanting to show what they had learned. And most often that was the same kind of learning which everybody had, or somebody which was a friend of theirs. That's called the Mutual Admiration Society, or the Adoration Society, or just a small clique of people who then start to quote each other, and in that way pretend that there is a new kind of information, but they just recycle the same kind of knowledge or the same kind of platforming in a small group. And so when they at some point created this instrument called the citation index, where essentially it said how many publications are being used by others, that probably means that they are relevant publications, that might give the idea that these are relevant stories. And some people then demonstrated, a group of people got together and said, okay, now let's see how that works. They wrote a text which was totally nonsense, meaningless, and they had enough clues in there, in the search terms and in the keywords and in the references, so that other people thought that it was a relevant story. And so it became one of the most quoted, most cited papers, and sort of was at the top of the list of the citation index. And then they showed that it was a bogus paper. And essentially their whole purpose was to demonstrate that the citation index was a bogus system. And I had to learn that in those kind of conferences, people just rehash information, and by the published of Paris principle, they had to go to these conferences. Often there were individuals who then would go to holiday resort places, so the Bahamas or Athens or who knows, different places where then this group got together. Everybody paid to stand on a little pulpit and tell their story, and they got 20 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, or if they were really important, maybe an hour and a half. And afterwards, hardly any time for questions. Not easy to ask questions anyhow, because the topic was often very different. If people could ask questions, it was because the content of the paper was already known, and not much was added to knowledge. So that whole system of circuses, traveling circuses, going to the fashionable places where people then got together, was much more a place for people to meet up privately, because professionally it was often not so high level because of those regurgitations. And one of the difficulties I found with such kind of conferences is that I would have to send in a paper, say a year beforehand, and then it was admitted half a year beforehand, and then by the time that I was at the conference, I was already doing something very different. And so for me to go back to something which was already passé became irrelevant. So I ended up only going to the cybernetics conferences, which are funny because everybody works with the system theory, which is the kind of Swiss pocket knife of science. It has been incorporated into all branches of science in such a way that the people who are in those disciplines don't even recognize it to be system theory anymore. And as everybody uses that same mental technique, created by Ludwig von Bertalanffy, as general system theory, there is the same kind of systemic approach to looking at things. And so it could be that people talking about boat building, carpet weaving, Arabic tile design, computer design, social systems, medical systems, astronomical systems, they could all understand each other because they understood the way of thinking, and as a result could cross-validate that what they knew from their discipline had other examples or more details in another discipline. And so that is also where a lot of interdisciplinary thinking is possible, and that I think is also very important in the understanding of that transition from tuition to intuition, because in tuition basically it's about established or existing knowledge, maybe even regurgitated existing knowledge, maybe, as I mentioned before, the undigested, unchewed carrot being put back on the table, kind of knowledge regurgitation, which is where no real progress is being made. The only progress is that, yes, it works somewhere else as well, or a little detail can be added here, or now we can apply there as well. While in system theory, there's a much more fundamental way of thinking, just as in mathematics. And mathematics too has that patterned thinking. That's also why mathematics is such a powerful tool in all of the sciences, because it doesn't look at what you're looking at. It looks at how you're looking at it. In my terminology, you have physics. First you have nature, which is the thing which we have around us. And then when you put part of it in the laboratory, you get physics. You can measure it, you can touch it, you can prod it and take it apart. And then when you take, say, the material aspect away from it, you find mathematics. So you can describe patterns and come up with a more general kind of understanding, because it's about relationships. And once you see that there are many kinds of mathematics, and you can switch from the one to the other, just as a psychiatrist can go from one model to the other to describe but not to really explain, then you need to go to the logic. And as Ernst Binz did, you then can, through the logic, connect these different forms of mathematics and come to a deeper understanding. In my terminology, that then is metathematics. You go to the themes which are underlying mathematics, because in the logic you can connect them, you can switch them. But at the moment that you're working at that level of logic, you're looking at relationships and changes in relationship which are now no longer connected to anything in specific. And for me, that's also why that connects to, say, the foundation of intuition. So with all of that understanding in place, the engineering school, which was about the physical, the medical school, which was about how we experience and live things, then also the conferencing circuits in how can we think about things, how can we think about things better. With my background as a having become a teacher, or having been licensed as a teacher as well, I developed this concept of tuition and intuition, which simply summarizes everything that I have said before. I realized that tuition is practical. It's good to have books. It's good to have knowledge. It's good to know how you can apply it, when and where you can apply it. But that is limited and that is brittle. So you need to add intuition, and the intuition comes from realizing that there is edges to what you know, understanding that there might be other applications to what you know. It could be that there are other forms of representing the same as what you know. I think again of Évariste Galois, who had a different kind of mathematics to solve the problems, and the teachers of the examiners did not know that. So there's always that need to trust on intuition, on the one hand to question the reality that you see, on the other hand to question the model, the knowledge by which you look at it. Because if you use the wrong knowledge to look at the reality, then you see a distorted reality. If you put pink glasses on your nose, you will have a different color perspective or color perception than people have green glasses on their nose. And as it is said, if you go into a surgical practice, do expect that the doctor who's treating you will at some point want to hold the knife. While if you go to an internal medical practice, they will already have their pots of poison at the ready. So in the same way with science and philosophy in general, the mindset that you have will give the inclination of how you look at things, and thus how you perceive things. And that can be distortive, but it can also be destructive. So there needs to be that ongoing questioning, the calibration of the mind, so to say. Is the theory, is the model, is the line of thought, is the form of wisdom, science that you're using, appropriate? Even if it has been validated in many kind of circumstances, It will be invalid for the specific kind of circumstance for the simple reason that science is never about the specific, it's never about the particular, but it's always about an observation sometime in the past by somebody else. So there needs to be that flexibility to translate from what somebody else knew to what you know, to the situation somebody else was working in, to the situation that you're working in. And the filling of that gap cannot happen by knowledge, for the simple reason you don't have the knowledge that who the other individual was, you don't have the knowledge about what the other situation was. So you need to fill that in with intuition. And then, of course, it becomes possible to realize that you need to actually turn it around, because that's also how we learn in our lives. Babies are not born with an encyclopedia in their head. The whole notion of artificial intelligence is pretending that the baby is born with an encyclopedia in their head. The baby is born with a tabula rasa. The capacity of learning is the primordial instrument. As discussed in this talk about Jesus versus Christ, Jesus from Joshua, the teacher, the pundit, book knowledge, Christ from Krishna, the consciousness, the intuitive knowledge, there needs to be that connection between the two. But as we can see in a baby, the learning starts with the intuition. You don't need knowledge to be able to build up knowledge. The notion of science that things are unscientific is nonsensical, because if science doesn't know, you find out. Same as in the medical schooling in Maastricht. If you don't know, you say, okay, I'm going to look that up. So science is very much about looking things up instead of pretending that's in the book already. And then when it says that the snake spaketh, that the snake has spaketh. No, if you don't understand metaphor, and if you don't understand meanings, then you cannot understand what is written. There's always that need to understand that, as the Bible says it, do not trust the graven image, which includes everything written, or everything that's measurable, the numbers, but trust what you can actually see and what you're actually experiencing. Don't replace reality by the model. Understand that it is always about the realization, and that means tuition is wonderful, but it is only meaningful if it is based on intuition. The intuition, is it true, or is there something else going on, needs to be on the foreground. That sharpening of that sense of is it correct, or is there something fishy going on, needs to be the basis of everything, because otherwise you cannot see if tuition or knowledge is reliable. People might be repeating things for centuries, and it's only later on that a new theory is developed by an individual who then shows we need to look at things differently. So why have people been hypnotized, mesmerized, and repeating something again and again because the tuition said so? And how come that they ignored and denied their own intuition that things could have been different? So if you put the tuition on the second place and the intuition on the first place, so you have Krishna consciousness as the starting point, the capacity of learning of the baby. And then as the baby learns, knowledge will build up, things, items will go into memory. Memory will connect, start to build structures, start to build a body of knowledge as a kind of replica of what goes on outside. As the Indians say, first you have samsara, you have vibrations, impulses on the surface of the body that through the sensory cells, the neurons, the plexus goes into the brain, which creates maya, an interpretation of what goes on around us. But you cannot not then say that the interpretation that you have is the reality. The map is never the territory. So tuition is never the learning. The tuition can only be matched into the reality by the realization that it is intuition which gives the meaning. It is there where we connect to it, and that's also where I then, for a longer while, explored this whole project called Tuition and Intuition, which was basically represented by the words tuition with a capital T and intuition, small I-N, capital T tuition, so that the word tuition was there, but tuition and intuition, the inner tuition, the tuition from within, was how that then became visible. And between tuition and intuition, the word and was written by an ampersand sign, which of course has this symbol of the straight line of making distinctions, and this S line is which is at the core of the yin yang symbol of connecting the part to the whole. So in that way, in the ampersand sign, tuition is represented by that slash symbol, the either or way of thinking, and the intuition is represented by this snake line, this serpent line, this S-shaped line of the logistics curve connecting the part into the whole, and thus establishing the integration. So that in the ampersand side you have separation and integration combined, which is also the representation of the juxtaposition of tuition and intuition. And that basically ends this exploration. Thank you.